Welcome to From the Newsroom. Reporters and editors from the Worcester Telegram and Gazette step from behind the keyboard and in front of the mic to offer insights on stories they're working on. From the Newsroom, from the Worcester Telegram and Gazette.
I'm Executive Editor Dave Nordman, joined today by reporter Kim Ring. Welcome, Kim.
Thanks, Dave.
Kim, you've had a fascinating series over the last month and a half called Lives Left Behind. First of all, an outstanding job on that series so far.
Thank you.
Well, let's just start from the beginning and tell us what the series is about and how it came about.
So a lot of times we get to talk with Peter Stefanik, Graham Putnam and Mahoney Funeral Home for a variety of different reasons. And almost every time he's mentioned the 300 cremations in his basement that have been on claim, some of them since the 1800s. And we were talking about it one day, and I thought, you know, it might be kind of a good community service project if we could try to find where those cremations should go and maybe find the relatives that should have claimed them and just remind them.
How many cremations in his basement?
There are around 300, probably a little more than that.
Three and all unclaimed?
Right.
Wow.
So we talked to him about the possibility of maybe just starting with a few to see how difficult it would be to connect them with their family members. And I went back there in January, picked out three, and got their files, went through them.
So just a little bit of background about how these remains, hundreds of them, end up in Peter's, the basement of his funeral home.
So some of them are still there from the Putnam Funeral Home and the Graham Funeral Home.
How many years? I mean, we're skipping around here, but how long do these go back?
Back into the 1800s.
Wow. So he's got 300 boxes, remains?
Some are plastic boxes. Some are wooden boxes. Some of them are, you can look at the cremains to see the difference from what they looked like then to what they look like now. You can actually see bone fragments in some of the boxes that are older. And a lot of them have still some paperwork taped to them. Some of it's illegible. So
he's got, you know, 300 and some odd remains in his basement. And it's, you know, he just keeps them there. Why? I mean, it's just sort of his civic duty to keep them there. I mean, tell me how this works, because I know he's a funeral director, but you know, it doesn't seem like this is a regular part of the job.
Well, he is a funeral director, and he's probably best known for being a funeral director for folks who don't have a place to go when they're dead. So he takes people from all over New England.
The most high profile being?
His most high profile would have been one of the Marathon Bombers.
Right.
Who was at his funeral home for a few days while Peter worked really diligently to find a place to bury him, and he does not turn anyone away. And so some of those people that he doesn't turn away don't have any family. They're wards of the state. They end up, you know, their body is found and no one ever comes for them. So he has a certain time period, and then he can have them cremated. And he can now, because of a new state law, actually bury them after a given period of time. But he tries not to do that because he's always hopeful that somebody's going to come for them.
Wow. And we're talking to reporter Kim Ring about her series Lives Left Behind. So tell us, you know, you had this idea and you approached Peter about it. Was he receptive? How did sort of the series get underway?
So if you know Peter, you know he loves the media. And this was another opportunity for us to work with him on something that he's really been trying to do for a while and just does not have that kind of time. So I talked to him about taking a few of the cremations, just giving it a shot. And initially, the first one was pretty easy. There was some phone numbers in the paperwork, and I just called them, even though they'd been around for a while.
Well, so is it, to kind of get into the details, you're in his basement, you're kind of, you know, looking around, like library style, looking for like a good book to read, you know, just kind of put it bluntly. I mean, how did you choose the first one?
So
you mentioned it has paperwork attached to some of these boxes.
It's basically a name and a cremation number, and they're just stacked up on shelves, not unlike library books. But there's not a lot to see. And so, I don't know, some of them just, I try to pick by the year, like if it's not too recent, but recent enough that I might actually have some success in finding a person to claim them. And then I picked three, And the first person I picked, I opened her file and it had her occupation and it said journalist.
Oh, well, that's a good place to start. And her, refresh our memory, her name was?
Her name was Janice Frank.
Okay.
And, she was a science fiction writer and a journalist and passed away. And we found a phone number for her daughter in the paperwork, but it was old.
So how long was she left unclaimed?
Oh.
It's
been years.
Yeah. You know, you're looking through, you find the box, Janice Frank, and you know, it had some paperwork there.
There was some paperwork there, and I did some Googling, and you know, with the internet, we have a lot more resources now than we would have had, you know, even 15 years ago. So I found her daughter's phone number. I called it. Her daughter's partner answered the phone, and it was a shocking phone call for them.
So they didn't know?
They knew she had passed away. They knew she had been at Graham Putnam Mahoney. There was some confusion about whether or not Graham Putnam Mahoney just buried her, or they weren't really sure what happened to her ashes, and they didn't think they would ever see them again.
Wow. And so you started out this conversation by saying it was sort of your mission not only to tell the stories of these people, but also to reunite the ashes with family members for a proper burial or for some closure. So how did that first reunion go?
So the first reunion was actually pretty fulfilling to be able to do it on the first one. So they came out from Amherst to Worcester and I met them at the funeral home. We took some photos and they sign a few slips of paper and they bring their ID and everything to prove they are who they say they are. And then we hand the cremation over to them and they can take it home, bury it, display it. So Janice's daughter was taking her cremation home, just giving some thought to how she was going to handle the next steps.
You said she was, it was kind of shocking when you told her the news. It must have been emotional, you know, during the reunion time.
It was. And I was kind of surprised because you don't really know how to deliver that news. And sometimes you're not sure if they even know that the person is dead. The most recent one, the family didn't know that she had died. So we're telling them this for the first time. So it's shocking for them.
And you tell them, obviously, you're a reporter and you're doing doing this series on lives left behind. Have you run into any sort of opposition or people that don't want to talk to you? I mean, cold calling is one thing, but this is a whole different story.
It is, and it's a strange kind of sentiment. And I have a psychology background, so I think that's helping me a little bit with this because to make that kind of a phone call, it can be really upsetting for a person to hear. The most recent one, Mary Gagnon, her family didn't know she had died.
Wow.
And, you know, she was the first one that I got stymied on, and I wasn't able to find anyone to claim her. And I know going into it, I really had hoped that it was all going to be easy, like Janice Frank's and also Wayne Cross's were pretty fast. But this third one, really, I hit a wall and I felt frustrated with it. We had gotten a subscription to Ancestry.com. We couldn't really find anything. I was going down roads that were just rabbit holes and I couldn't come back.
Yeah, before we talk about Mary Gagnon, you know, after you did Janice Frank, was it easier to do Wayne Cross? I think that's the second one, right? Was it easier doing the second one, having the first one under your belt, kind of making that call the second time around?
No. It's still a surprise to the person on the other end of the phone, you know, and you want to gently deliver the message without really shocking them too much. But this guy, Wayne Cross, he didn't really have any family, but he had a girlfriend, Cynthia Patricks, who had passed away before him. And I always kind of have a picture in my head of what they look like, and it's always wrong. It's always totally wrong. And Wayne Cross, because he had fallen on the floor and been really sick on the floor of his house for days, gone off to the hospital and then passed away. I kind of had a vision of him as an older guy. But what I found out was he had a really colorful criminal background. So it was shocking. He had actually shot a woman in a robbery.
Wow.
But in his later years, he became very devoted to Cynthia and turned his life around and then died from, you know, a lot of medical issues that he had.
And how did that the reunion of Wayne's ashes go?
So Cynthia, his girlfriend's ashes, are with her sister.
Okay.
And we found her, and she she was willing to take Wayne's ashes and put them together with his longtime girlfriend. I believe they were actually engaged when she passed.
So you found Wayne's girlfriend's
sister. Yeah. And she was willing to take the ashes and she'll have them interred together, which she said was what Cynthia and Wayne both would have wanted.
Wow. And sort of to fast forward to your most recent one, story, Mary Gagnon, which ran this just past week in two parts. And I guess, not to tell the story, I'd rather have you tell it, why it was written in two parts. And you said you had a little bit of trouble with this one from the beginning.
Mary definitely was a challenge for me. And I found out later why. What I didn't know was that Mary, she was sort of not a social person. And I initially thought she was one of just two kids, but it turned out that she was one of six kids. And I just kept going down these Ancestry.com rabbit holes, and I just couldn't seem to pull myself out into a place.
So, in full disclosure, I'm here saying, Kim, where's this story on Mary Gagnon? Where's this story on Mary Gagnon? You go on vacation, you come back, no story on Mary Gagnon, because there just was not a lot of information out there on her.
There was not, and it was pretty tough. And it was also frustrating me because I really wanted to be able to say, look, we returned another one. But we weren't able to do that on deadline.
In the story we printed in Sunday's paper a week ago, basically was more of a play-by-play of, you know, you went here, you went there, you know, you turned here. So tell me kind of how that process went and kind of the frustration that you felt along the way, given the success of your first two.
Well, the first two kind of had ties to our area, and Mary was from Waltham. So there was a challenge geographically to try and figure out who to talk to. And then her family had owned a business, and there was another business in town that I called, and they were familiar. So that lady went home and talked to her mom, and she called me back and found some info. And then another woman in the clerk's office in City Hall called me back, and she had some information. But I literally was just calling people in Waltham if I thought they might have something. And a few people responded, but then the story ran saying, you know, we can't find anybody to take Mary. It just killed me to have to do that. But what happened after that was the readers, who are amateur sleuths and genealogists, picked up where I left off and found places that I had not gone.
So tell our listeners about those phone calls. And again, we're here with Kim Raine, Telegram and Gazette reporter, talking about her series, Lives Left Behind. So we're talking about Mary Gagnon. We ran a story in Sunday's paper basically saying, you know, in a nutshell, like, I need help here because these are all the places we've looked. We don't have any really good answers as to find the relatives here, and the readers step in.
The readers did step in, and I've never gotten as much email on a story as I did on this one.
So what did the readers find? How did they help you out?
So the readers started finding that Mary had other siblings aside from the one older brother that we knew about, and they started finding their addresses and their phone numbers, and they were passing that on to me. A private investigator reached out to me, and he said, you know, I saw this, and I love a good mystery, and I also love to solve one. So he pointed me in a few directions, but what really sealed the deal was that Mary's niece, Deborah, who is a Boston attorney, was sent the story by a cousin of hers who said, I think I found one of our relatives. And she reached out to her aunt, Eileen Ouellette, who is Mary's sister, her youngest sister that's still living. And Eileen said she had really spent a lot of time trying to figure out what became of her older sister. They just didn't know. But Mary had sort of withdrawn herself and ended up in a group home, and then was struggling with dementia, ended up in Framingham, which is far away from Waltham and not where they were looking for her. And the facility she was in has either closed or changed hands. And Mary's ashes were sitting in Graham Putnam Mahoney for 7 years, and they were not sure Mary was alive or dead.
So how do they get to Peter's funeral home? I mean, in this case, do we know?
Well, there's a little weird caveat with Mary's story in that she had been appointed a guardian who's an attorney in Northborough, and I probably called him, I'm going to say at least 8 times, probably more than that. And he never picks the phone up, and he says, I'm in the office at 5 p.m., but he never is. So he was supposed to take care of things for her, and I don't really know what his level of responsibility was. But when Mary died, there was really no one to take her. And so Peter Steffen came and took her.
So you file the story on Saturday. It runs in Sunday's paper. So take us through the timeline from there. So Sunday, I'm assuming your email and your phone starts ringing right away on Sunday?
I did, yeah. I started to get these, you know, amateur sleuths who were really doing a great job of looking things up and pushing me in directions. Some of the directions I had already been in that were sort of dead ends for me, but other people were able to step in and follow those and go down some other paths. And then I got the email from Deborah, the attorney in Boston, saying, you know, this is my aunt.
And so story runs on Sunday, kind of take us to when your follow-up story ran.
So I emailed back and forth with Deborah. She looped in her Aunt Eileen. Her Aunt Eileen said, we really want to come and get Mary, and we want to have that closure. That
and when, piece of closure. When was this?
That was Monday, maybe,
Monday.
Or Tuesday.
Well, like the next day or two.
So, and I said, you know, let me know when you want to come. We'll set it up for you. We set it up, and they came out this week and picked up Mary's remains, signed off on the paperwork, and brought her back home.
So this is, it's 3 for 3 now.
We're 3 for 3.
3 for 3. So we started out with Janice Frank and Wayne Cross. Great story there. You know, the Mary Gagnon story, which looked like it was going to be a dead end, thanks to our readers, turned into just a really great story, a two-part story. So 3 down, and do you have your next installment? Are you sort of, you have it picked out?
So there were some baby cremations that have been unclaimed, and I'm going to step into that in the coming weeks. And those are going to be pretty difficult to find parents for, because some of those babies are born prematurely. And then I've been told there are some religions and some ethnicities that don't want the ashes back. And that might be a possibility for one of these cases. That
now, it sounds like, not to interrupt you, Kim, but it sounds like the first one, it was, you know, it was the journalist. You kind of had some info there. The second one, it was... You know, Wayne Cross, a great story. The third one, you kind of ran into a brick wall, and the readers helped you out. It seems like you're kind of, you know, you're challenging yourself kind of as these things go along a little bit.
These babies are definitely going to be a challenge,
yeah,
for me. I mean, they didn't live and have a history that I can trace anyplace.
Right.
So that's going to be tricky to find out. There's probably a birth certificate and probably a death certificate, and that's it.
Yeah, and so what is the game plan when it comes to kind of, you know, having done this 3 times, and you know, where do you start? I mean, do you start with the paperwork? You mentioned ancestry. There's, you know,
I start off with the death certificate.
Yeah,
pretty much that's the first thing, and it has a lot of information on it, and it'll paint a little picture for you, tell you about the person's job. But you know, if you're a baby that's born prematurely, you don't have any of that. And then I can go over to City Hall and pick up a birth certificate and a death certificate, and that's going to give me the parents' names. So I will tell you, we have stepped a little bit into this and notified a person that we think is a relative of one of these babies, and I am not sure what the outcome is going to be, but it was quite a shock for that person to hear that.
Yeah, and you're, again, as a reporter, you're calling people and sometimes delivering news that they've not only don't want to hear, but it's you're delivering news that they may be hearing for the first time.
It's true.
Wow.
Yeah. It's shocking for some of them.
Wow. I mean, just, again, a fascinating series. You know, every time one of these stories runs, they seem to, you know, gain a lot of momentum, and readers seem to be kind of coming on board with being interested in reading these stories about these people whose, as the series says, whose lives have been kind of left behind. So thanks for, you know, kind of taking us through the whole series, Kim, and just looking forward to your work on the next one.
Well, it's been really interesting road to go down, and I think, you know, as journalists, we should do community service, and I think this is my baby. I'm probably not going to stop until I can find homes for all 300 of those if I live long enough.
All right. Thanks for joining us, Kim, and thanks for the thorough explanation. And, you know, maybe we can come back here in a couple weeks and talk about a few more of these.
Thanks, Dave.
Thanks, Kim.